This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. I know. Last week I said I looked forward to Major League Baseball's All-Star break as an opportunity to take a break from baseball. But even though I said that, and I meant it, we're going to start this week with a story about baseball. And I promise it has nothing to do with the 10-inning All-Star game played on Tuesday night. This story comes to us from WBUR's Erica Lance.
Big play by Jim Abbott.
Two-run single for Abbott.
What a moment for Jim Abbott.
Crowd with Jim Abbott every pitch of the way, the last three.
Years before he was a major league pitcher, Jim Abbott was a regular kid in Flint, Michigan. It was in elementary school that he started to develop a real discomfort with being different.
I remember instances of recoil from kids.
They recoiled because they saw his birth defect. Jim's right arm ended at his wrist, so he was missing one hand. Some kids teased him. Back when he still used a prosthesis, they called him Captain Hook. When he could, Jim hid his right arm by burrowing it into his pocket. There were many moments of simple frustration.
You know, I was in a classroom coloring something, and so I was writing with my left hand and trying to hold the paper on the desk with this prosthesis, and it ripped the paper, and I had worked really hard on it, and then all of a sudden it was torn.
Art was difficult, but he loved to throw a rubber ball against a wall for hours. His dad taught him to quickly take off and put on his baseball glove so he could catch and throw with the same hand. But while he could handle a baseball, Jim still faced a daily challenge.
I didn't know how to tie my shoes. I remember my parents tying my shoes for me and triple knotting them.
It might seem small to the rest of us, but if Jim's shoe came untied at school, there was nothing he could do but ask for help. Just the kind of attention he dreaded and made him feel like an outsider. When Jim was in third grade, his teacher was Don Clarkson, a tall, charismatic man who had worked at NASA. One day, Mr. Clarkson pulled Jim into the hall and said, "I figured it out." Jim wasn't sure what he meant, but Mr. Clarkson started untying his own shoes, and Jim followed suit.
I think he put a film on for the rest of the kids in the classroom, and we sat outside sitting in, you know, those little small elementary school chairs. And he started working with the loops and the laces and working with one clenched fist.
Apparently, Mr. Clarkson had used his evenings to invent a one-handed shoe-tying technique.
And then I tried it, and then he did it again, and then I tried it, and then he did it again, until ultimately, you know, after probably a few days of practice,
he could tie his shoes. For Jim, it was a lesson, one that would quietly reverberate through the rest of his life.
A lot of people assign these labels to my baseball playing. You know, it's courageous and motivational, inspirational, and all these things. And so much of it was about generous, supportive people who believed that there was a way to do things a little bit differently. And Don Clarkson embodies that as much as anything that I can recall from my childhood.
In the years to come, Jim's discomfort in the classroom was outweighed by the thrill of the field, the one place he could be like everyone else, or way better.
Although I wanted to do well in sports, a lot of that ambition initially came from just wanting to fit in.
He developed a deep love of baseball and a drive to excel. He could hardly believe it when his dream came true. He reached the major leagues. And he'll never forget how it felt when, one day in his first year with the Yankees,
he did it! He did it! No-hitter for Jim Abbott!
He pitched a no-hitter.
To think that that could be you seemed almost impossible.
Mobbed by his teammates.
Jim had never been someone who wanted to stand out, but it's hard not to when you play baseball without a right hand.
I didn't want to be the human interest story. As much as I tried to run away from those stories, they persisted. But what also started happening was kids and families started to come to the ballpark. A lot of them missing a part of an arm or part of a hand or facing much different challenges and much more severe.
Parents wanted their kids to see someone like them. Jim seemed like the perfect role model.
We'd meet outside of a baseball clubhouse doorway, you know, in a dark hallway, a corridor, and we'd have these encounters.
In the dim light, Jim had to face the part of himself he'd rather hide, and he became a reluctant hero. He also noticed something. A lot of kids asked, "How do you tie your shoes?" So he'd get down on one knee, pick up his laces, and show them.
Switching places with Don Clarkson, I'd be the tall one, I guess, in my baseball uniform, and, you know, it'd be a little boy, a little girl.
Eventually, it became the first thing he did when he met a kid missing a limb, something that said more than words.
I found a way, and they can do it too. I've been on one knee many times, you know, undoing my laces and tying them up again.
Jim retired in 1999, but kids still send him letters and photos.
You know, just in the past month, I've heard of three or four different kids who I've communicated with over the years who are going on to play college baseball. And it's just part of a chain. It's not me. It's part of Mr. Clarkson. And hopefully it will continue to filter on down the line, and people will always believe in more being possible than less.
Jim's helped countless kids come to terms with their differences. But in his own life, he still grapples with missing a hand, which is why finding himself back in a classroom for his daughter's preschool career day brought old insecurities to the surface.
You know, I had every visual aid known to man. I had my gold medal. I had, you know, baseball cards, my baseball hat.
But at the end of his talk, his daughter zeroed in on perhaps the most critical question and raised her hand.
And I called on her, and she said there amongst her friends, "Dad, do you like your little hand?" You know, I didn't really know what to say. I fought the temptation to put my hand in my pocket. And yeah, I said I did.
The kindness Don Clarkson showed a young Jim Abbott was simple, but it stayed with him for decades. And now he's passing it on as best he can, one pair of shoelaces at a time.
That's Erica Lance speaking with Jim Abbott. Abbott's biography is Imperfect, An Improbable Life. And if you'd like to hear more from Erica, check out the magnificent podcast she produces for WBUR. It's called Kind World. You can hear more stories of kindness and share your own at wbur.org/kindworld. Before Jim Abbott, way before Jim Abbott, there was a kid I knew, also named Jim. We called him Jimmy. I haven't seen him since perhaps 1962. I have no idea what he did with his life after junior high school, but for some years before 1962, I saw Jimmy a lot during the fall and the spring on the warm afternoons after school let out. That's when he and I and a lot of other boys would head for the park a few long blocks from the school to play pickup baseball. This was not Little League. Later I'd play Little League ball, proudly wearing the uniform of the Commonwealth Club Cardinals. This was not even Cub Scout League, where we all played before we were old enough for Little League. Though, come to think of it, some of the Cub Scout League games were on the same dusty diamond in the park where Jimmy pitched. Tours Park, it was called. Pitching is what I remember him doing. Skinny, right-handed, sidearm delivery, scary as it could be for a right-handed hitter, which I was, because Jimmy lunged toward third base before he released the ball, throwing across his body so that the ball seemed to be about to hit you in the back before it veered across the plate, except for the times when it didn't veer and just hit you in the back. What was also scary was that Jimmy grunted when he let go of the ball. He sounded like some of the tennis players do today, loud. I hated hitting against him. My guess is that a lot of other hitters, especially right-handed hitters, hated it too. Nah, I don't have to guess. I suppose we all knew that Jimmy had had polio. I mean, knew in the sense that if anyone had asked us, we'd have said, yeah, he did. The back brace he wore was too big and bulky to conceal, especially under summer clothes. But nobody did ask, and as far as I can remember, none of us ever mentioned it to him or to anybody else. That has to be wrong, doesn't it? I mean, we must have talked about it, but I don't remember doing so. And though I don't remember thinking about it then, I guess the brace was the reason he didn't throw overhand, unless he was just mean and understood the fear he could create by swooping across the mound and slinging the ball to the plate via the third baseline. In any case, I don't remember him saying he couldn't throw any other way. I don't remember him making excuses. I also don't remember ever seeing him play another position, and I don't recall seeing him hit, which, come to think of it, if he didn't, that maybe gave him an advantage over other pitchers. Nobody could throw at him. All this was, as I've said, a long time ago, nearly 60 years, so who knows what I've forgotten. But I remember that none of it seemed remarkable at the time. Chucky at second base was being raised by his mom because his dad had died. He had an older brother we thought was weird. Johnny, who played third base, had a big brother too, and he'd starred in football at Princeton. We'd seen the pictures and the tributes in his dad's den. Ray, at first, also had an older brother, and soon that brother would die in a gruesome automobile accident. And Jimmy had had polio. That's all it was. And he was a ball player at the park, like Chucky and Johnny and Ray and the rest of us. It was only years later that I started to think about what it must have been like to pitch in a back brace. I guess it was being reminded of what Jim Abbott did that got me thinking about what Jimmy had done at Tours Park. I hope he's doing okay, too. During his 4 years at Yale, former rower Mike Danziger didn't spend a lot of time focused on academics.
There were going to be 1,000 other people who were better, and I wasn't going to get anything out of that. But if I just focused on rowing, I would learn a lot more about myself.
That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR. I'd like to thank Faison 000 for leaving the following review of Only a Game on iTunes. As a sports fan and lover of public radio, this podcast takes what I love about both of those things and wraps it up in a wonderful hour of listening. Sports! Consider visiting iTunes and leaving a review of your own. It's the best way to help other listeners find our show. I'm Bill Littlefield, and it's time for Three Stories You Should Know. This week, we're going to talk about Bob Dylan and home runs, whether or not they're blowing in the wind. Joining me are the Wall Street Journal's Jason Gay and SB Nation's Charlotte Wilder. Hello, and welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Bill! How are you?
Charlotte, I gather that you are back from an exciting trip, so please share.
Oh, yes. Recently, I was in Miami for MLB All-Star Weekend and the Home Run Derby and the All-Star Game. And I was really struck because, so during the Home Run Derby, I'm sitting there in the press box losing my mind. I was so excited. There's nothing better than dingers. Like, these home runs that these guys were crushing, it was like the best birthday party anyone's ever thrown me. The crowd loved it. It was electric in there. I mean, it was a really spectacular event. And then the next night, you come back, and it's the All-Star Game, and there were some empty seats, and it's sort of slow, and there are no stakes because it no longer determines home field advantage for the World Series, which, and I talked to a bunch of players, and they're like, thank God, because that didn't make any sense. But, you know, there wasn't this sense of urgency, and then the game just dragged on, and sure, it was silly and kind of fun, but by the eighth inning, I was like, oh my God, are we still doing this? And so I have this proposal that I think the All-Star game should only be 7 innings, like a rec league softball game. And then if it's tied at the end of 7 innings, it goes to another home run derby. Mm. And whoever smashes the most home runs in one rotation wins.
Jason, you like that idea?
Listen, I think all baseball games should be 7 innings long. I mean, have you gone to a baseball game on a weeknight in America? You're sitting there looking at your watch from about 9:30 on. There are 4 pitching changes per team this season in baseball. When was the last time you came back from a baseball game and said, you know what was great? The 8 collective pitching changes. Mm. I mean, they need to curtail this madness.
Maybe, based on what you two are saying, Major League Baseball should follow the lead of Major League Soccer and constantly change the format of the All-Star game. You know, 1 year it's East against West, next Arsenal comes in and plays the best MLS players, and then they have somebody from the La Liga in Spain come in and play. It's, you know, hey, we're going to please everybody at some point, just not all the same year.
To me, the thing about the All-Star game is that it's a fun break, and you know, and maybe it's not even anything you have to do anything about. Maybe this is just a silly, fun thing, and that's how it's going to be, and it doesn't need to be fixed, but it could just be a little bit shorter.
I heard someone years ago describe All-Star games this way. they're for kids.
Yeah.
You know, and when me and you, Bill, as geezers, sit and try to reinterpret what the All-Star Game is supposed to mean, we're missing the point, which is that they're not for us.
All right. I would like to stick with home runs, but I'd also like to preface what I have to say by asking all the dinger lovers not to hate me. During the first half of the Major League Baseball season, there were home runs aplenty. In June, more home runs than in any other month in the history of the game. That's maybe enough to make some people suspicious of Major League Baseball's contention that the ball hasn't been juiced. People who are happy about the increase in home runs are saying the home run is what makes baseball exciting. Maybe Ty Cobb is spinning in his grave, and Pete Rose would be spinning in his if he weren't still alive. Am I the only fan who would prefer to avoid another steroid scandal, especially if it is going to involve Congress? Maybe the players should be encouraged to hit more doubles. I may be the only fan on the planet who doesn't need half a dozen home runs for a game to be entertaining. Charlotte, I'm sorry. Tell me I'm wrong.
No, I mean, I actually agree with you that I think that we haven't seen a ton of great base hits or, you know, the smaller plays that you're sitting there going, ooh, maybe this could become something, as opposed to, you know, I love home runs. That's why the Derby's great. But if everybody's striking out except for, you know, smashing the ball, there's less nuance.
You know, regarding the home run derby, though, not enough credit goes to the batting practice pitchers who were serving up those meatballs that the you know, that you can hit out of the park 47 times in 15 minutes or whatever the heck it was.
It should be like bobsled. You know, they're a team. They're a battery. The two of them together, that should be your winner.
Exactly.
But can I just go back to this home run conversation? I've got some bad news. You're both crazy, okay? I cannot believe, Bill, you're sitting here saying you want to see more doubles.
Triples.
Charlotte wants to see more base hits. Who doesn't love home runs? What's the matter with you guys? Home runs are the special sauce of baseball. It's what gets people energized. I think the issue with baseball, unequivocally, is the interstitial doldrums between all the home runs.
Maybe we can have all of it. Like, maybe we can have, instead of doldrums between home runs, we can have doubles between home runs. Maybe we just have, like, tons of stuff happening all the time, and baseball becomes the most exciting thing you've ever seen.
Let me just lay out a possibility for you. A triple, right? A guy hits one into the corner. The outfielder's after it. The infielders are lining up. It's going to be a relay. It's going to be a close play at third base. The guy slides in head first, just beats the throw. That's got to be more entertaining than a guy watching his long fly ball leave the park, flipping his bat, and trotting around the bases. Come on.
Bill, what you're saying is that you don't want walls anymore in baseball. So let's just create limitless outfields. Just tundra.
All right, Jason, it's your turn.
I'm up. Well, it's mid-July, and you know what that means, Bill and Charlotte. It's time to talk about the Super Bowl halftime show for February 4th, 2018. This week, there was a rumor afoot that Britney Spears had been asked to play the halftime show, which next year is in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And the nation was shocked. Shocked because she might not be the proper choice. Prince, of course, would have been the ultimate Minneapolis halftime act. But Bill, I am here to tell you that the next best choice is none other than Bobby Zimmerman of Hibbing, Minnesota, a.k.a. Bob Dylan. Mm. If the man can win a Nobel Prize, I think he can pull off a halftime show. I know the Dylanologists might disagree with me. They might think it's going to be a 90-minute halftime show, but I'm willing to roll with it. He's an American icon, and it's time to give him his due.
I mean, I love Dylan. I grew up in a household that loved Dylan. But I have a very important and completely correct take that Beyonce should be the only person who ever performs at the Super Bowl halftime ever in the history of, or in the future of football. She's the only person I want to see on stage. So,
I kind of feel like the Super Bowl should be a halftime show of a Beyonce concert at this point because she's so big.
She's so good, though.
How would you feel about Beyonce and Bob Dylan trading verses on Tangled Up in Blue?
Oh, I'd feel like, I'd feel great about that. Yeah, I think that it should be Beyonce for the future forever, but she gets to bring guests up. So, you know, like a Bob Dylan at a Beyonce halftime show that just continues for the second half of football, and then we don't have football anymore, and it's just a Beyonce and Bob Dylan concert.
Bill, I can hear you rolling your eyes from here.
Well, you know, all this worship of Beyonce notwithstanding, I'm going to go with Bob Dylan at the halftime show because, yes, I think it could be easily done. You just put some bleachers out in the sun and have it on Highway 61. And it would work as long as Bob Dylan didn't complain about being stuck inside of Minneapolis with a Malibu blues again, right?
Ah, Bill, you're a Dylanologist. I knew it all
along.
Hey,
I grew up with this stuff, man.
Wait, Bill, are you secretly a Bob Dylan impersonator?
Well, I'm very flattered that you think I would qualify. That was my first attempt
that
to
was
actually
incredible.
Impersonate.
Let me ask this, though. My fear is this. I have no issue at all with Dylan's ability to pull off a halftime show. One song might take the 12 minutes up.
Well, I mean, he could sing the Titanic, and it would.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Hurricane, and you're pretty much there. Mm-hmm, it's only an 11, 12-minute event. Mm-hmm. I'm worried about one nagging issue. The man didn't go to his Nobel Prize ceremony.
You think he might not show up at the Super Bowl?
I think they need to have a backup plan, what I'm saying.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been the Wall Street Journal's Jason Gay and SB Nation's Charlotte Wilder. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Thanks, Bill.
When Mike Danziger began his freshman year at Yale in 1981, he received a letter from the lightweight crew coach. The coach informed Danziger, who is 6'4 and then weighed about 145 pounds, that he had the perfect body for the lightweights. Danziger had never been told he was perfect for anything. He showed up at the boathouse, and there he remained.
I rode all 4 years at Yale.
And how did your coaches feel about that?
My coaches were a bit frustrated with me because they wanted to get rid of me.
But they couldn't cut him. Tradition at Yale has it that crew doesn't cut anybody. As long as you showed up, you could compete for a seat in a boat. The only way to get cut was to quit. But as longtime Yale coach Dave Vogel might have put it, though Mike Danziger was persistent, he wasn't any good. So he rode in the boats called shells full of other guys who weren't any good. And like the other guys in his boat, he understood absolutely the distinction between the accomplished oarsman and everybody else.
I literally worshipped some of the guys in the top boat. We described them as gods. There's Mike Hard. He's a god. Andy Morley. He's a god. I wouldn't dare to speak to them. And it took me 2 years to gather the courage to introduce myself to Mike Hard.
Rowing may be the most demanding of sports. The practices are grueling when the oarsmen are on the river, and worse during the winter when they're inside in tanks or on rowing machines called ergometers or ergs. The repetition can be numbing. Like wrestlers, rowers on a lightweight crew often have to cut weight, which means hunger and thirst and time in the sauna. And oarsmen like Mike Danziger, if there are any other oarsmen like Mike Danziger, begin to understand fairly early on that they aren't likely to become gods. So why do they keep coming to the boathouse? In part, at least, it's to pursue something they call swing. Danziger first heard about it when he was riding back to the campus after a practice on the river. He was sitting beside one of the members of the women's crew.
And she said, "How was practice today?" And I said, "It was brutal." She said, "Did you guys swing?" And I said, "What's swing?" She said, "It's like an orgasm. I mean, you can't really describe it, but you know it when you're having it."
The conversation gave Danziger something to which he could aspire.
Swinging is elusive, and it's that moment where every single oar goes into the water at the exact same moment. And not only that, the power is applied at exactly the same time throughout the stroke, and the oars come out the same. And at that moment, when you swing, the sum is really greater than the parts, and the boat seems to be flying on the water.
3 weeks after he'd heard about swing from the woman on the bus, Mike Danziger, well, better he should tell it.
Our boat was getting ready for the Harvard-Yale-Princeton race, which was the biggest race of the year for us. All of a sudden, these eight misfits with their misfit coxswain started to float on the water, and we could feel it, and it was amazing. And all of a sudden, we were ahead of the third varsity boat. They weren't swinging. The coach's launch came over next to us, and Dave Vogel said, "You guys did it, and if you can do that next Saturday, you're going to cream Harvard and Princeton." Well, we didn't, and we got blown away. But for that one moment, I knew what it was like to swing. It happened to me once, and I'll never forget it, and it validated everything that I did. It was incredible. And there are guys who, every single day, they have that experience. And what I wonder is, does that make it less special? Do they take it for granted?
Given that Danziger wasn't making much progress toward Godhead while he was at Yale, he welcomed the opportunity to row elsewhere, in Italy, as it turned out. Though he'd gone there during the summer between his sophomore and junior year not to row, but to study art and architecture.
And I was walking through Florence, and I was looking at the Ponte Vecchio, this old bridge that passes over the Arno. As I looked down, I saw boats coming out of a boathouse. And it was the Societa Canottieri Fidense, which is the Society of Rowers in Florence. And I walked in there, and it was really a social club. People were drinking their cappuccinos. And this very large, incredibly well-built guy came up to me, and he said, "Ciao, mi chiamo Roberto." So I said, "Ciao, mi chiamo Michele." Then he asked me if I wanted to row with him.
Roberto didn't mention his credentials, but later the steward in the boathouse told Danziger that Roberto was no weekend sportsman.
Roberto was an Olympic rower from the Italian national team. Mike Hart and Andy Morley would do anything not to row with me. And here was a guy who said, "Let's take out a boat together."
In Italy, oarsmen didn't have to be divided into gods and scrubs, and never the twain shall sit in a boat together. Danziger rowed with Roberto twice a week that summer, which had to raise his stock, right?
When I went back to Yale in the fall for rowing, I thought, wow, I spent the whole summer rowing with an Olympian, and this will be great. And Dave Vogel read the call of all the people that he was expecting, and my name wasn't on his list because he just figured that I had quit. And not only hadn't I quit, but I spent the whole summer rowing with an Olympian. Who else had done that? And I remember he said, "Oh, Danziger, you're back." And I said, "Yep, I'm still here." And I remember what he said. He just said, "Well, suit yourself."
So Danziger did that. When he wasn't rowing, he suited himself, though not precisely as the coach might have imagined.
I was the Yale Bulldog, and the Yale Bulldog wears this blue furry suit. He's got a paper mache hat on and gloves, and the outfit came with a letter sweater.
And lettering as a rower didn't seem likely, but being the mascot sounds like fun, eh? Sometimes, not always, as Danziger discovered on the job at a Yale football game where the actual Handsome Dan, an authentic Bulldog, was being introduced to the crowd.
And we hated each other. We came out to the 50-yard line, and he slipped his leash, and he took off after me, and I started running away. And these were the days where there were 40 or 50,000 people in the Yale Bowl, and I got to the sidelines, and I thought, oh, I'm safe, but I wasn't safe because these dogs are tenacious. They're bulldogs. And I turned around, and he was right there, and he pounced on top of me and started mauling me, and I could hear the crowd cheering, and he's ripping away at my skin, and finally the security guards came and pulled him off. And I figured, you know, sort of after that humiliation, that sweater was mine. So I did end up with a letter, but it was because I was the mascot, not because I had achieved anything.
As previously revealed, Mike Danziger rode throughout his years at Yale. He never got anywhere much, but he never quit, and he doesn't regret the choice he made, though it came with consequences.
You know, I had an opportunity when I was at Yale to spend time every single day with the very smartest people in the world, talking about the things that turned them on the most, and sharing their passion and their knowledge and their experience and their perspective with me. And I didn't. But I got stuff out of Yale that maybe nobody else did, or very few did, you know, which was cold comfort to my dad, who described paying the tuition at Yale like buying a brand new car every year and driving it off a cliff.
After Yale, Mike Danziger began the Stepping Stone Foundation. Over the years, it has helped a great many disadvantaged children get a college education. Somewhere along the line, Mike Hart, one of Danziger's gods, became godfather to one of Danziger's sons. More about Michael Danziger's experience as Yale's worst oarsman ever is available in his new book. small puddles. The first Rubik's Cube World Championship was held in 1982, and then as fast as the cubing craze had risen, it died out.
If you're a local guy and there's no one in your area who's cubing, then that's not much fun anymore.
What brought back the Rubik's Cube? That's just ahead, and you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
Hi, I'm Erica Lance, and I think you might like this podcast I produce, also from WBUR, called Kind World. Kind World tells deeply personal stories about the pivotal moments in our lives.
She called me one day and she says, "Why are you choosing to live in our grief?" And I said, "I'm not. I'm choosing to live in your love."
All of those women were witness to the darkest and probably most intimate moment of my life, and they gave me a sliver of light.
I talk to all kinds of people about times when they felt alone or scared or overwhelmed and how they got through it with the help of others.
I even thought I was a little crazy, but then I'm like, wait, I could do anything I want. I could raise $1 million if I want to. I could cure this disease.
I think that he bypassed all that and just said, "I see a human being who needs my help and I'm going to help him."
Head over to WBUR.org/kindworld. Or just subscribe in your favorite podcast app.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, we will revisit Rio a year after the 2016 Olympics. But now it's time for my discussion of the week's news with Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
The result of Major League Baseball's All-Star Game no longer determines which team will get home field advantage in the World Series, and I wonder if that's why the players seem to be having such fun at this year's game. Catcher Yadier Molina taking pictures with the umpire and wearing a shiny chest protector that looked like he belonged in a Hercules movie. This is great stuff.
This is a lot of fun, although Yadier Molina looked more like C-3PO than anything else.
I guess we take our references where we can find them. Alex Rodriguez took advantage of the All-Star break to announce in a New York Post column his four-point plan to save baseball. Here it is. Live pregame cameras in the batting cages, weight rooms, and bullpens at all 30 MLB ballparks. A partnership with Google to display fun facts about players when they come up to bat. $10 Tuesdays. And microphones on every player, manager, and coach during every game. I don't know whether baseball needs saving, and I don't know whether these innovations would do the trick. What do you think?
Oh, man, though, I'm all in for $10 Tuesdays. Are you kidding? The rest of the stuff, I could care less about seeing players in the weight room, to be perfectly honest with you, but I'm sure there's an audience for it out there. I'm all in for $10 Tuesdays.
The Chicago Cubs recently gave up a raft of top prospects to acquire left-handed pitcher Jose Quintana from the White Sox on Thursday. Does this make the Cubs, the defending champs, even better?
Well, it better because they're not playing real well right now.
No, they're not.
It gives them another starting pitcher. It gives them a left-hander. He's fairly young. He's kind of a workhorse. He's thrown 200 innings every year for the last 4 years. This is the kind of deal that Theo Epstein makes. This is the reason Theo Epstein builds farm systems.
Las Vegas bookies are very happy that the Chicago Cubs won the World Series last fall. But why has it taken them so long to realize how happy they are about that?
For the same reason that I still have my $2 ticket from the Belmont when American Pharoah won the Triple Crown. People aren't cashing the checks. People are saving them and, you know, handing them down to hopefully to a child or a grandchild who's smarter than Grandpa was and will go cash and make some money.
The New York Knicks have a successor to former GM and Zen master Phil Jackson. What do you think? Will Scott Perry cure what has been ailing the Knicks for some time?
I don't know. Did they change owners? Because, again, this is the problem. The great unsolvable problem for every fan base is a bad owner, and the Knicks have a bad owner.
Boxer Floyd Mayweather and MMA fighter Conor McGregor have begun a promotional tour for their August 26th boxing match, and it's been fairly entertaining. I wonder if it'll end up being more entertaining than when they meet in the ring.
I hate this event. I hate this event with the heat of 1,000 suns. It's a circus. It's ridiculous. They're using the foulest possible methods to promote it. I hope everybody involved loses their shirts, which apparently Conor McGregor doesn't really need anyway because he rarely wears one. You know, just get this out of my face. Seriously. I have not been offended by a sporting event like this in a long time.
The International Olympic Committee announced on Tuesday that they are awarding the 2024 Games and the 2028 Games at the same time. This is going to take place in September. They've never had a doubleheader like this before. Why now?
Well, I assume it's just a bookkeeping technique. It's easier to, like, keep track of two sets of bribes at one time than spread them out over 8 years. So that's exactly what I think is going on.
All right. I have another theory that I want to run by you on this.
Okay.
They've got some bidders now. And if they hesitate with the 2028 Olympics, more cities may recognize they don't really want to host the Olympics at all. And the gravy train the IOC has been riding forever might end. What do you think about that?
That's entirely possible, too. I put nothing beyond these people, as you know. And... they may just want to lock in a couple of cities and then hope for the best in 2032.
Chuck Blazer died this week. He was known to many within the swamp that is FIFA as Mr. 10%. I can't imagine how he earned that nickname. Anyway, then he became known as the wealthy FIFA potentate who had thrown lots of other FIFA potentates under the bus to at least somewhat save himself. And apparently, some of what he told investigators will live on to the dismay of his former associates, meaning there are tapes. And so perhaps haven't heard the last of Chuck Blazer.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, this is the one that eventually brought down Sepp Blatter.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a significant figure in the history of international soccer. We'll just leave it at that.
And finally, Charlie, we learned this week that Andy Roddick has thrown away his many tennis trophies, and his wife, model Brooklyn Decker, was out of town when he did it, and she says that he broke her heart. I would think most wives would be all for their husbands tossing away old trophies, but I guess in this case I'd be wrong.
She apparently liked them. Maybe she has a gift for decorating with large gold cups.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated from time to time. And, of course, he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
When was the last time you did this? That, in case you haven't already figured it out, is the sound of someone solving a Rubik's Cube. The six-sided, six-colored puzzle invented by Hungarian designer Erno Rubik enjoyed a brief run in the early 1980s as the best-selling toy in history. Rebecca Shear brings us the story on the many twists and turns the cube has taken over the past 40 years.
When the Rubik's Cube hit shelves worldwide in 1980, it immediately became popular. And when I say popular, I mean like Pokemon popular, Harry Potter popular. By 1981, sales were in the hundreds of millions, making it the best-selling toy in history.
Back in my university day, back in the crazy cube times, you could sit in a lecture hall with 100 people and hear 10 or 15 cubes being discreetly turned around the room.
Were you one of those people playing with the cube in class?
Sometimes.
In 1981, Lars Petrus became the fastest Rubik's Cube solver in his native country of Sweden. And as such, in 1982, he found himself here.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the first ever Rubik's Cube World Championship to be held.
Petrus was 22 when he walked into that massive concert hall in Budapest, Hungary, birthplace of the cube.
Mr. Lars Petrus, Sweden.
Were you nervous?
3, 2, 1, go.
Of course. I think everybody was nervous.
Oh, very fast. Oh, very fast.
At 24.57 seconds, Petrus' solve was indeed very fast. But Min Tai was even faster, just under 23 seconds.
The world champion, Min Tai, from United States of America.
That's Mr. Rubik himself, handing Tai a gold-plated Rubik's Cube. There was talk of holding another world championship the following year in Los Angeles.
But that never happened.
Jessica Friedrich represented Czechoslovakia at the 1982 World Championship. She was 17 and the only woman to compete. As the 1980s wore on, the allure of the Rubik's Cube wore off.
What happened? Why were people not as crazy about it?
It's just that it wasn't popular. It wasn't mainstream.
maybe it was just too darn hard to solve. A Rubik's Cube has more than 43 quintillion possible combinations. That's 43 followed by 18 zeros. It didn't come with an instruction manual, and this was decades before you could Google instructions or watch a tutorial on YouTube. So people were getting frustrated. Some would take it apart and put it back together. Others, and yours truly may have been guilty of this one, would peel off and rearrange the stickers. Toward the end of 1982, Saturday Night Live captured the growing exasperation with its tongue-in-cheek ad for the Rubik's Grenade.
Just scramble the colors, pull the pin, and then begin. Rubik's Grenade may be the last puzzle you'll never solve.
So, suddenly you had hundreds of millions of people shoving their cubes in the backs of closets and drawers. But not Jessica Friedrich.
Wherever I went, the cube went with me.
It wasn't just solving the cube that she loved. It was practicing hours a day to find quicker, more effective ways to do it.
Nobody knew what the best system was. There were no computers that could just outsource this job. And this process of discovery and the unknown was what mesmerized me, what kept me cubing.
Over the course of a few years, Friedrich came up with a system for solving the cube. It involved memorizing at least 50 algorithms, or sets of movements, to get a piece of the cube where you want it to go. More than a decade later, in 1997, Friedrich posted the method on a little something known as the Internet, just for kicks.
I thought no one was interested in cubing. No one would even just spend their time and memorize all the algorithms.
She was wrong.
People would search and they would find the page, they would learn the system. It became extremely popular. I had no idea how popular it became until about 2000.
That's because by the time 2000 rolled around, the World Wide Web had given the Rubik's Cube a jump start.
I don't think without internet I would still be cubing because there was no one else to talk to.
Ron van Bruchem fell in love with the cube in the 1980s as a teenager in the Netherlands. When the fad died out, though, so did his interest.
If there's no one in your area who's cubing, then there's not much fun anymore.
Fast forward two decades, and cubers were posting their solve times and email addresses online, thanks to a CD-ROM called Rubik's Games. Then came a Yahoo group called Speed Solving the Rubik's Cube, inviting cubers to trade tips and techniques. And in 2000, Ron van Bruchem started an online forum called speedcubing.com.
Is it true that you invented the term speed cubing?
Well, what's funny is that I got contacted by Webster that they were planning to include the word in the dictionary and that they attributed the word to me, so that was really nice.
Just to give you an idea of how cube-obsessed Ron van Bruchem is, his wedding was Rubik's Cube-themed, replete with a six-colored cube cake that took 4 days to make. Plus, he now has more than 1,000 cubes in his house.
Even in the bathroom and in the shower.
Are cubes waterproof?
Well, I have specific cubes that I save for some other stuff. Yeah.
Anyway, after starting speedcubing.com in 2000, van Bruchem became a leading voice in the growing online cubing community. Before long, talk turned to picking up where the 1982 Rubik's Cube World Championship left off.
I said we should have a competition. I would love to meet you guys somewhere, someplace.
Van Bruchem connected with a Canadian cuber named Dan Gosby, who offered to take the lead. And in 2003...
Competitors from all around the world came to compete at the Ontario Science Centre.
Nearly 100 cubers descended on Toronto.
It was for us a really big reunion, and it brought the people together, and that's what it was all about.
This was the first world championship since 1982. But here's the thing. It drew 5 times more contestants, and there were far more categories of competition. Beyond solving the traditional 3x3 cube, you could do the 4x4, the 5x5, dodecahedron and tetrahedron puzzles. You could even solve blindfolded. So there wasn't an established precedent for how things should go. As a result,
there was a lot of misunderstanding and also some unfair decisions that were made just because we didn't know the exact rules.
For instance,
we never really set a time limit. So there was one competitor who couldn't even solve the cube. And he even took like 1 hour. And then finally we decided, well, come on, you can even solve it if you can do it in 1 hour. So we had to stop him.
After the event, some cubers voiced their disappointment online. And organizer Dan Gosby took it hard. Seems he still does. He turned down my request for an interview, saying he didn't want to relive the experience. But the willy-nilly nature of the 2003 World Championship actually had a silver lining. It turned competitive speed cubing into an organized sport when Ron Van Bruchem co-founded the World Cube Association. The WCA wrote up detailed regulations, everything from how a competition area must be lit to how far away spectators have to stand while someone is solving the Rubik's Cube. Now, at this point, I should clarify something. When we're talking about competitive speed cubing and we say Rubik's Cube, we're not actually talking about the Rubik's Cube, because since the mid-2000s...
The old 80s Rubik's Cube has been mostly phased out.
This is cube solver and cube innovator Chris Tran. His company, The Cubicle, engineers speed cubes. They look like Rubik's Cubes, but on the inside they have high-tech features like magnets that make them smoother, faster.
These new Rubik's Cubes have special features that hold themselves in so you can turn them about like 100 miles per hour and the pieces won't go flying.
Wait, wait, you said 100 miles an hour?
Oh, it's a little bit of an exaggeration, but a lot of these kids, they turn about 4 to 9 moves a second.
It's true. As cubing has taken off, solve times have dropped. Remember in 1982 when Min Tai wowed the world by conquering the cube in under 23 seconds? Well, by 2009, world champ Brendan Vallance was solving it in under 10. And in 2016...
Oh!
Felix Zemdeg solved it in under 5. That's half the time it takes Usain Bolt to run the 100-meter dash. These days, roughly 20,000 people compete in cubing events around the world. The World Cube Association holds nearly 700 competitions a year, from Guatemala to Algeria to Mongolia. Just like in Jessica Friedrich's day, most of these cubers are males, though the number of females is growing slowly. But whether they're guys or girls, the majority of today's cubers are, like Chris Tran said, kids, teenagers, if not younger. In this digital age, a new generation is getting hooked on this old-school analog toy. Lars Petras, the guy who represented Sweden in the 1982 World Championship, thinks he knows why.
I mean, it's a very simple thing. It weighs nothing. You don't need any battery. It doesn't break. You can have it forever. And now, pretty much anyone can learn it from the internet. And it's a lot more rewarding when you can actually finish the puzzle.
To quote the man who started this whole thing, Mr. Erno Rubik, if you are curious, you'll find the puzzles around you. If you are determined, you will solve them. For Only a Game, I'm Rebecca Shear.
More than 1,000 competitors are in Paris this weekend for the 2017 Rubik's Cube World Championship. We'll have a link to the competition at onlyagame.org. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our intern is Philip Goldberg. And our senior producer is Karen Given. Our final word this week comes from former Yale rower Michael Danziger, who has big plans for his book.
If this book ever gets published in another language, I'd love it to be in Italian because it's piccolo pozze, which means small puddles. And I just love the way that sounds.
Still hoping to row again in Italy, eh? May the translation happen. May the book signing go well. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.